Spanish. My ex-wife was Venezuelan.
Oh. Yeah.
How about we begin that night that I was arrested? How about that?
Okay, perfect.
All right. The night I was arrested, I went to work about an hour early, like was my custom, just to drive around the outside parking garage of the healthcare clinic that I worked at as a night shift security guard. And I seen this black van, and I didn't think much of it because I thought it was a cleaning crew. It was common for me to rehearse escape routes all the time while I was at work. And had I known that that was the FBI, I would have tried to run, but I didn't. I came in, it was my last day at work. I was training a new security guard, and suddenly I was surrounded by about three FBI agents and two state police officers. And the whole meat and potatoes of that is really not that important. But what's more important was once I was arrested, they took me to a county jail, and I've never been in trouble a day in my life. So I was terrified out of my mind because I'm surrounded by people who I was, you know, taught, you know, as a kid, like these are criminals, crooks, like they're dangerous, they're scary. TV cultivated in my mind that they're violent, that they're very rapey, and that is true to some extent, but my first interaction with a prison guard was so let me ask you this. You know, I've watched a lot of TV. So am I gonna get raped or something? And he didn't say a thing. He just laughed at me. And I've never had to strip off my clothing in front of other people. I've never done it a day in my life. I'm stripping off my clothes, and you know they're checking me as they're processing me, and they put me in a tank full of about 12 men, a very, very tiny cramped up tank. It's called a drunk tank for people who are detoxing off of narcotics and alcohol. And my first thought in my mind is I'm probably not going to make it in a couple hours unless I make a friend. So I devoted my attention to trying to make a companion in there, make a friend. So I would have somebody to click up with, because I knew nothing about prison, you know, except for what I was taught in American culture. No sooner had I made that friend, I was extracted from the cell because I was on a federal hold, on a federal crime, and I was put in solitary confinement for about 3 days and three nights. After that, I was processed and I went to Siegelville Jail. And it just so happens that's where I ended up meeting Matthew Weeman, the AKA Little Hacker, the blind phone freak. But anyways, I'm so scared. My first impression as I'm walking through the doors, this big Hispanic fellow walks up to me and says, "Hey, you got any medication you can sell me?" And he's bugged out. His eyes are bulging from his head. He looks like he is seriously screwed up. And I'm like inside, I'm freaked out. So I'm a little guy. What, I'm 5'8", and probably weighed about 120 pounds soaking wet. So like I didn't shower, okay, for about 2 weeks. Like there's no showering going on here because the shower stalls are open right behind the guard desk. There's no veil or shower curtain. Everybody's butt naked. Like, this is not my thing. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know what's going to happen. So I'm bird bathing in the sink, you know, with a rag. And I'm so scared that I can't even go down and feed myself. So I have to have my cellmate bring me my food. And he helped kind of ease me in because he had been locked up a long time. And he was friends with some of these old school characters that had been in the system their whole life. And they helped bring me in to, you know, acclimate a little bit. So I'm sitting there, and like my first interaction with prison inmates was actually with the men who were on the Holy Land conspiracy. the Palestinians who allegedly use the Holy Land Foundation, you know, charity organization as a means to send money to Hamas. So I'm sitting with them because they're nice and they were sweet and they didn't look like criminals. as time went on, like, people were really, really excited about my case. They wanted to hear more about it. So they treat computer hackers with a level of awe and intrigue, because they're so rare. They're exceedingly rare. I could probably count on maybe three fingers how many hackers I had actually met in the system. So anyways, I was on the news, the local news at the time, and people were just really excited. But the prison culture was, I mean, it's traumatizing for someone who wasn't raised like this. Like, I'm not from the streets. I may have grown up on the streets up until the age of 7 years old, but I wasn't cultivated by the streets. I was raised in a very prestigious household, very, very fancy people. And I was shielded from this type of reality. So there was a lot of fighting, a lot of beating and blood, people going to the hospital, people with black eyes, teeth being knocked out. And this is very jarring psychologically for someone who's never witnessed this type of interaction. But the thing in my mind is, I told myself that if I don't immerse myself in the culture and try to fit in some way, shape, or form, it's going to end up scarring me in some way, or I'm going to become a victim. Like, the thing about me, if you read my book and you talk to me, you know, I experienced bullying growing up in school. So the thing that attracted me to computer hacking was I found a means to defend myself in a way that would cause me to never become a victim. But see, having the computer taken away, now I was, you know, shown the realization that, you know, I might very well be nothing without this computer. I mean, I ended up realizing that's not true, but at the time I didn't know this. Without my computer, I didn't have any power to defend myself. So I had no veil, no masks to hide behind. So I was forced to face the ugly realization that this was going to be my reality from here on out. And so I found ways to survive so I would not become a victim. I didn't join any gangs at this time. I didn't really have to. I had ended up making friends with every ethnic group in my pod, but, you know, it was extremely scary. There was a few times I had physical altercations, but with someone my size and the fear that I had, like, I had to go all in. I fought dirty. I had to win because I didn't want to be one of those guys ended up, you know, in a hospital or someone who was killed. You know, I love life too much to lose. But I didn't like the person that I ended up having to become. But my entanglement with the system really just, it had a way of changing me at the time. I mean, I spent 11 years a part of that system. You know, it kind of brainwashes you. But now I'm not in that system, and I'm having to slowly clip away, you know, the parts that had clung to me so I could enjoy being a human again. It's very dehumanizing. Yeah. It has a way of robbing the soul.
Yeah, it's an evil system, and exactly what that you have said, all the things that you have mentioned are so like the things that I live, that is amazing. I have, before the situation that I had to live, I never had a trouble with police, I never went to a prison, to a jail to visit anyone. I was completely outside of the system. And from one day to another, my life changed completely. And I was inside a world that, as you said, it was full of people that were part of the system, that were in and out, and they knew the codes, they knew how to behave. Violence was part of their life. They took for granted that life was like that. And I didn't take that for granted. For me, life was different. For me, life was having everything I need whenever I need, be with my family, have normal friends, stay out of trouble. And I was inside a system where I, like you, I said, okay, I have to integrate myself into that system. Otherwise, I would be a victim of something very bad. So for me, that also was terrifying. The moment my lawyer told me I was going to prison, for me, it was like my mind went blank and I look at the wall and I was almost crying because I thought to myself, this is the end for me. I won't be able to survive. I couldn't imagine how could it be. And I had all the things that you see on TV and all the situations that you think might happen. I thought they would happen to me, that I was weak, that I wouldn't be able to cope with a day there. And it was the end of the world. And I spent 5 days in a jail where they profile you, they make you some medical exams, they take pictures of you, like, I don't know, they have like 2,000 pictures of me, your tattoos, and they are evaluated by doctors, so they decide which prison to send you. And well, I was sent to a low security prison in the middle of the country, and well, we talked about this yesterday. The day I arrived at night, somebody whose nickname was The Bull, with a voice that was like all like this, told me, hello, what's your name? Alberto, I'm The Bull. Oh my God. And he told me, why don't you take a shower? And I was like you, I mean, I was not used to be naked in front of other people, even though the shower was individual. I was like, no, I don't want to take a shower, but I cannot deny what the Bull is telling me to take a shower. I have to take a shower. He's going to kill me if not. And so I did take a shower. And when they asked me, why are you here? And I was without communication for 5 days. I didn't know what was going outside. And I said, no, it was because of a hacking of a medical provider. And then there was a silence. Everybody was looking, watching TV. They turn around and say, oh my God, you are the hacker. Wow, you are the hacker. Oh my God, you're an idol. And I was like, wow, what? How do they know about me? Yeah, I was in all the newspapers, TV, and I wasn't aware of that because all the media was like in the front page, first hacker, sent to prison in Uruguay, and it was like, wow, how did they know about me? For me, it was amazing, and the fact that they look at me first with apathy, but then with such empathy, I mean, they were like admiring me, and for me, it was like, wow, and later on, that became a reason why I didn't have any trouble, because I gained kind of respect, because I was like a strange thing that had some knowledge that was for them completely unknown, but I could do things they could not do. So I was like something they could not understand, and they treat me in a way that, I don't know, respect and my admiration. And that was something that I think helped me a lot to survive in that environment. But yeah, the thing that happened to me were basically the things that happen to you, the steps that you enter in an environment that is completely unfamiliar with you, you are terrified, and then for the crime that you supposedly committed, they see you with another eye. You said you met three other hackers. Well, I didn't meet any hacker. I was the one and only. So we began the same way, and also my interaction with the Interpol when I was arrested was not nice at all. I was without a lawyer. There was no physical violence, but psychologically, they were destroying me. I mean, shouting at me all the time because we were talking different languages. What I was trying to explain them, what I was explaining them was things that were things that they didn't understand. So I don't know if it's part of the way the interrogation, they are prepared to interrogate people, but they are very, very brutal. They don't know how, you cannot have a conversation face to face, saying the truth, being honest, and in, and get the same from them. No, you are lying, tell us the truth, and that destroys you. And
it's psychologically terrorizing.
Yeah, absolutely. And as you said in the podcast, you think that when they arrest you in your case, the FBI, they knew everything about you. Well, the same happened to me. I thought that they knew everything about me, but they knew nothing. They knew nothing about me. They were all, they were talking to me in the interrogation, and they didn't do, know anything about me. And later on, I realized so many things that for me were like, oh my God, these guys were so stupid, and I was also stupid. I mean, I should have kept my mouth shut. I would shut up and not talk to them, ask for a lawyer, but they didn't tell me my rights. They didn't tell me anything. They put me in a cell of 2 meters by 2 meters. I was freezing cold. I didn't have my medication. I have asthma. They didn't give me my medication for the asthma. I mean, that plus the psychological torture was like they put you in a situation where you are also handcuffed in front of two guys with a passion again. And when you enter the system, you are not a human being anymore, not for them.
No, that's right.
So
that's absolutely right.
And that's it, absolutely unfair, absolutely, it's like we're living in the century 19, I don't know, shouldn't be like that. We are in 2020, open your mind, free your mind, sorry. It happened in 2017 for me and 2011 for you. But I lived something that I didn't know it was like that. For me, it was sort of like, TV movies about police and the bad guys were really bad, when actually I understood after this, my story, that there is no actually good and bad, mostly. Who is the bad boy? Who is the good boy? It's not like the police for having a badge and again, they're the good boys, or the judge.
I know.
No, I changed it completely in my mind. I don't know if a better person or a worse person after this experience. But I am a different person that sees the world in a different way, and it was an open-minded experience. I see the things through different eyes than what I used to see the world. I really opened and I understood nothing is what it seems. Nothing is black or white, good, bad. It all depends on the eyes of the beholder.
That's very true. You know, I was raised in a very patriotic household. We were, you know, a very Republican household. And I may have heard conspiracy theories, but I never believed that the justice system or law enforcement was capable of conceiving some of the crimes they commit in order to convict people, everyday people like you and me. The sheer lengths that they will go to secure convictions. It is so bizarre. So in my experience with law enforcement, hearing the testimonies, blatant lies coming forth from law enforcement just to put me in prison, even, you know, in conjunction with my all, you know, my already, you know, established guilt, was just mind-blowing. It was like a slap in the face to witness and experience firsthand what they will go to put a person behind bars.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. The same happened with me. I have a file of 1,000 pages where it's full of lies, false information, altered information, Well, in my book, I wrote 13 lies that are told in the file that I can prove that they are lies, and the judge didn't do anything. I mean, the judge accepted them, and they are lies. There's false information. They created a monster of me. They first came for me for the attempt of extortion for the medical provider. And then they said that I was cloning credit cards, I was hacking bank accounts, and it was like, wow, this is our trophy, the first hacker that was sent to prison because of all these crimes, and he had the mask of Anonymous, so he's guilty. This is the ultimate evidence. So
wow.
It was a disillusion for me to understand that justice is just a beautiful word, but it's nothing more than a word. Justice does not exist. That for me, I had to live 41 years of my life to realize that justice is just a beautiful word, but nothing more than that.
I absolutely agree. Let me ask you this. What was one of the most heinous lies or fabrications concerning your case? What was like the worst one?
The worst one, it wasn't something that they did for me. The worst part was that later I can talk more about that in another episode, let's say, that they did to my girlfriend, that they arrested me first on a Saturday. On a Sunday, we didn't live together. And while they were executing the search warrant in my house, she appeared. I don't know why. I think they called her. I don't understand that part. But the thing is that they arrested her, and well, they kept us separated, and they started telling her that I had admitted the crime and that she was the mastermind behind everything, when she had nothing to do. I mean, I was accusing her of being the person who was behind the crime. That was bullshit. And well, they told her that I was on drugs, that I was stealing money for a long time. And she was thinking to herself, okay, I spent 8 years of my life with a person that I didn't know. It was like I was the evil. And they think she doesn't have any brothers or sisters. She's from a small town outside Montevideo, a very small family. Mm-hmm. And all she has is her work. And they threatened her, and they called her the place where she works, and they told the owner of the company the situation, that the girl was arrested because of this, of this, of this. And they told her, if you don't confess, you are going to lose your job. And that's all she had. That for me, I mean, it's not the pain that I suffered that was a lot, but what causes me the most pain is the pain that was caused to those I love. And the pain that they caused to my ex-girlfriend is something that I really suffer a lot. And whenever I remember that, for me, it's terrible because, okay, they can hit me, they can kick me in the floor, but don't do that to my beloved ones. I will never forget. I will never forget. I will never forgive that.
Wow.
Those bastards.
It's like they were trying to isolate you from any type of support you could possibly find while fighting this case.
Yes, absolutely. That's
monstrous.
Yeah, and absolutely they were not aware that they were in front of a person, a very humble girl that was nothing but, I mean, she was miles away from being a criminal, and these bastards are probably used to do the same with drug dealers, hitmen. I mean, they probably treat all the same way. They didn't know who they have behind of them. They have a person that was so naive, so innocent, so good.
Yeah.
And they treat her like that. Okay, they destroy her. After I was released from prison, she told me that she, after 6 months of being released, she told me, I cannot sleep at night. I wake up with nightmares. I think that I dream that they are breaking into my house, the police. And she was, for the first time in her life, taking medications to sleep and to treat that, because she's still suffering the consequences of that. She's still under treatment for all the things that they did to her. That's unacceptable.
I know what you mean. My grandmother, for many, many years, refused to have anything to do with me while I was in prison because of what happened, you know, to her granddaughter. My sister Jessica was my strongest supporter while I was locked up. Like, I mean, we became very close, and she was very proactive about researching the case and finding the inconsistencies in the media reporting. One day I was on the phone with her over a recorded jail phone call, and she was reading my emails. Now, I understood that the FBI had access to this email address. And she was telling me that it appeared that someone was sending emails pretending to be me. And I said, well, what are they sending? Can you tell me what's in the inbox? And she was reading them to me. I said, okay, well, delete this. Because I felt like someone was trying to incriminate me. So what ended up happening is those tapes were delivered to my prosecutor, and my prosecutor had a search warrant, you know, issued against my sister. So she was raided by the FBI and accused of being the shadow leader of my hacking group. While those phone calls were actually removed from evidence, while my prosecutor made it, you know, spun it in court that I was ordering my sister to commit obstruction of justice. So the actual context of what was happening was erased while, you know, she was dragged into my case. Her name was plastered all over the media, like on you know, the online edition of Wired magazine, in conjunction with like three or four other raids against ETA members. But they eventually dropped the investigation against her. But it really altered our relationship, not like yours, but it did change some things in the tenure of our relationship.